This partial government shutdown continues into its third week, and the hardest hit are people who can ill afford it. If the government is not reopened before March, millions of Americans who receive SNAP benefits, the nation's food stamp program, could have their assistance disrupted or scaled way back. We're looking at the ramifications here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue said Tuesday that the agency would rely on a budget provision to give states the money for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, for February ahead of time to get around the expiration of federal appropriations. So let's bring in Helena Bademiller-Evich. She is a senior food and agriculture reporter for Politico Pro. She's been writing about this, following the developments. Helena, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the latest here? What do we know about SNAP benefits, the status of SNAP and other nutrition assistance programs?
So I think first it's important to just remember who is on SNAP. So it's a really big program. Most people know it as food stamps. It serves nearly 39 million people, the majority of which are children, the elderly, or people with a disability. So this is a really big program that affects a lot of people in every state. And basically what has happened is there's been a lot of uncertainty as the shutdown has continue to drag on, because the program costs about $4.7 billion per month to give everyone the benefits that they need to help purchase groceries every month. So what USDA said this week is because the government shutdown continues and our appropriations are expiring at the end of January, they found a really obscure budget provision and basically found nearly $5 billion to cover February and give SNAP recipients benefits early. So SNAP recipients are actually going to see their benefits toward the end of January for February. So it'll be an early scheduled release.
So they're going to be available
in March. Yeah.
Yeah. Available on January 20th. So that's earlier than usual. So how does that work with the timing of it all?
There are a lot of questions we still don't have answers to. A lot of folks are wondering what happens. A lot of states stagger their benefits, so they don't give them all on the first, because otherwise grocery stores in some places would be completely overrun. So a lot of states stagger, you know, how they give them. Some people might get them in the first week or the second week. So it is definitely going to be a big change for a lot of these families, and we haven't gotten answers about how it's going to work in the weeks to come. So if you just got your benefits in mid-January, there's going to be some weirdness as far as how these are doled out. But states are working really, really in overtime trying to figure out all these logistics to make sure that everyone gets their benefits. We are right now being told that everything should work out for February, so that if you are on SNAP, you should not be concerned about your February benefits. And the government has said it's looking for options for how to fund March if it comes to that point. But they're really saying, look, Congress and leaders in Washington need to figure this out. They need to fund the government. So the hope is the shutdown will end before we have to deal with March.
And what about applications for SNAP? Are they still open? Because I think I read somewhere 95% of workers at USDA are off the job.
Yeah, so that is true, that 95% of the nutrition staff at USDA has been furloughed. But it's important to remember that SNAP is mostly administered at the state level. So if you find yourself in hard times and you think you need to apply for SNAP benefits, you can still do that. They are still accepting applications. We've started to hear reports of now federal employees who are seeking SNAP benefits because they, are not expecting their paychecks. So you still can apply. They are saying anyone who applies and qualifies will still get their benefits just as normal. So for right now, things appear to be operating as normal. The big question is what happens if this continues to drag on. The government does have a $3 billion reserve fund for SNAP, but as I mentioned earlier, it costs nearly $5 billion to pay out all the benefits. So whether or not USDA has other money they can use or other mechanisms to keep this going remains to be seen, but there is a lot of concern. I mean, food banks, anti-hunger advocates, people who work on this program understand how broad it is, and they really would like more clear answers about what the plan is going forward.
We're talking with Helena Bada-Miller-Evich. She is a senior food and agriculture reporter for Political Pro. Before this, she reported on Congress and the government for Food Safety News. You can call in 800-642-1234. Are you on food stamps? Do you rely on food stamps to get by? And what would happen to you and your family if you didn't have nutrition benefits? Are you concerned that the Agriculture Department will run out of money for food stamps? Will you have to choose between food and other expenses? And what could that mean for your life? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Helena, it's not just SNAP here that is caught in this partial government shutdown. There's also WIC for women and children. What is the impact on WIC?
That's a really great question. WIC does not get as much attention and coverage. Not as many people know about WIC, but WIC, which basically supports, it gives low-income families staple foods, infant formula, it helps support breastfeeding. It covers half of all babies born in the United States. So this is a far-reaching program, nutrition program, really targeted at pregnant women, infants, and young children. And there was a lot of concern about, you know, what was going to happen with WIC funding. USDA said this week WIC funding is also taken care of through the end of February, and they believe they have some extra funding to keep it going beyond that, but we still do not have clear answers for March. So it's in a very similar situation as the SNAP program. I also want to note that the school nutrition programs that serve, I think school lunch serves like 30 million children a day. The school lunch program and school breakfast programs, USDA has said, have funding to continue as normal through the end of March. So for right now, those programs are going to continue as normal, and we're not imminently worried about disruptions there. So I just want to note that because I know a lot of parents and families rely on those programs on a daily basis. So it's important to note that. There's so many questions that we're going to have to keep asking, you know, government officials as this drags on. I mean, there's just so many programs that normally are not affected in a shutdown. But if you get to a certain point, you start to see this sort of cascading impact in all of these programs that we normally don't even think about during shutdowns.
And you also see a shifting burden, perhaps, then onto states. States will have to somehow pick up the price tag and keep going here with these programs if the federal government continues to be on this situation of a partial government shutdown. Are states prepared to do this?
That's a really great question. And I think it's safe to say most states are absolutely not prepared to cover the cost of a program like SNAP. I mean, if a state gets $500 million in SNAP benefits. I mean, most states would have trouble randomly coming up with that kind of money for a month. This is an expensive program. WIC is definitely smaller in scale, so there might be a little bit more flexibility at the state level, but there is a lot of unanswered questions. There's a lot of uncertainty, and I do think it's important that WIC and SNAP recipients know that for right now, their benefits are not imminently affected. So I don't want to, you know, add to anxiety for low-income families.
Talking,
there is a lot of uncertainty in the long run.
Absolutely. Yeah. Talking with Helena Bada-Miller-Evich. She reports on food and agriculture for Politico Pro. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you concerned that the USDA would run out of money for food stamps come March? Will you have to choose between food and other expenses? Do you work in a school? How do you see federal food programs in action? Call in 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. More than 38 million people receive food stamps, and the government is guaranteeing funding for food stamps through February. But after that, there isn't a clear plan that we're aware of. The Department of Agriculture is one of the 9 federal agencies that shut down on December 21st. It's now guaranteeing funding for the nation's largest food aid program, SNAP benefits through February. We're talking about the ramifications here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Helena Bada-Miller-Evich is our guide. She is a senior food and agriculture reporter for Political Pro. And your thoughts on the shutdown as it pertains to nutrition, 800-642-1234. Have you gone hungry in the past? What do you remember about that time? And how did it affect your family? Do you see food assistance as a partisan issue? Is it best for Republicans and Democrats to compromise to keep benefits flowing, or should they take political sides here? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Helena, this isn't our first government shutdown, although it's longer than most. Historically, how have leaders handled food stamp benefits when federal operations are restricted?
Yeah, it's a great question. Food stamps are kind of a weird program because it's a mandatory entitlement program, which means that, you know, the parameters of the program are set in federal law and people who qualify get the benefits. There's no real question about that. But this is one of the few entitlement programs that requires appropriations. It's just a weird technicality that really hasn't been that much of an issue because they pass appropriations bills, you know, and they waive the funding through, and it has not really, only one time, I think back in 2015, did they start to worry they wouldn't have enough money for the next month. Food stamp benefits have never not gone out. So we're kind of entering an uncharted territory where the experts I talk to actually don't know what would happen if USDA has, let's say they have enough to do two-thirds of the benefits. Do they ration them, or do they only give them to two-thirds, you know, do the two-thirds of the recipients? I mean, there's just no guide for what will happen if push comes to shove. And they're legally obligated. They are legally obligated to give these benefits out. So there's a lot of questions.
Let's look at the politics of this for a moment and the optics here. The White House budget director Monday said they're trying to make this as painless as possible while still following the law. Does guaranteeing SNAP benefits help anyone politically in this budget battle? I mean, you know, here we are, Democrats versus Republicans, a border wall in the mix. Do elected leaders split along party lines when it comes to food stamps?
I think both sides see that any suspension of big government services like this or a risk of that puts additional pressure on political leaders to end the shutdown. And I think what we saw last week is White House officials were actually raising concern about SNAP potentially running out of money. And then a couple of days that later said, we're gonna find the money. Both Democrats and the White House were seizing on this. It was almost like each side thought that the specter of SNAP running out of money would raise, you know, their side's leverage against the other side. But I think what we saw happen is states panicked, low-income people panicked. There was a lot of confusion. And then USDA came back, I think, 3 days later and said, oh, we found the money for February. So it's very unclear to me, you know, in a political battle, who really gains the upper hand from raising big questions about whether or not SNAP benefits can continue. I mean, I think no matter what, it does put pressure on Washington to end the shutdown because so many people beyond federal workers, beyond people inside of Washington can be impacted by it.
You covered the passage of the most recent farm bill, and you write that it traditionally was a bipartisan effort that unites lawmakers over food stamps and farm subsidies. How has the farm bill become more political in recent years?
It's become a lot more political, I think in part as like the parties have polarized. There's definitely been a polarization, and I think the Democratic Party's also become skewing more urban, and the Republican Party's gotten stronger in rural places, so that's fueled it somewhat. But the last two cycles, we've had big political fights over the SNAP program, still known to many as food stamps, and how many people should be on it, and whether or not we should have stricter work requirements. And this last farm bill that Congress just passed, which ended up pretty much being status quo, keeping generally food and farm policy the same. There was a 10-month fight between Republicans and Democrats about whether or not you should impose stricter work requirements on food stamp recipients. And in the end, they didn't end up doing that because there wasn't enough political support to do it.
Yeah, so, and House Speaker Paul Ryan supported those work requirements for SNAP recipients, which, as you mentioned, didn't end up in the farm bill at the end. Governor Walker and Wisconsin Republicans are supportive of work requirements as well. How would increasing work requirements for SNAP benefits change this program in your view?
Well, they estimated that between the changes in stricter work requirements and also tightening up a few eligibility standards, that probably 1.5 million people would be dropped from the program. So out of 39 million people, that's a significant number, but it's not, it wouldn't have like cut SNAP in half nationally or anything like that. So I think anti-hunger groups were really worried that, able-bodied adults without dependents, which is this very specific population within SNAP, it's called ABODS in Washington. That's what the acronym is, able-bodied adults without dependents. And that just means you're, between the ages of 18 and 49, you don't have kids at home under, that are still in school, and you don't have a disability. And if you, the federal requirement is already that if you do not work at least 20 hours a week, on average, that you can't get SNAP for more than 3 months over the course of 3 years. And a lot of states have waived that. I believe Wisconsin is one of the ones that doesn't have any more waivers. So most people are already submitted to that work requirement. And a lot of anti-hunger groups think that that work requirement that we already have is too strict. They think that a lot of low-income people face barriers and challenges. Maybe their car's broken down. Maybe they don't have great jobs in their neighborhood. They work and they just don't make enough money and they don't want to deal with the paperwork of meeting a work requirement. It just adds another layer of requirements that low-income people have to meet. Conservatives say that it's a good thing. It encourages people to get back into the workforce if they have left it, especially in a time of low unemployment. So there's a heated debate about this, but ultimately this year, Washington ended up not making those work requirements stricter.
Let's go to Jonathan now with thoughts. Jonathan and Madison, good morning.
Hello, good morning. Yes, I just wanted to make a comment about how this is affecting the people that are producing the food, because I myself am a small vegetable farmer, and I'm applying for a microloan right now through the FSA, and that's being delayed because of the shutdown, and that could affect some deadlines that we have to meet to this year. So that's one thing that I'm kind of stressed about right now, and I'm sure there's many other farmers around the country that are feeling the same way.
Jonathan, if your microloan doesn't go through, what happens to you?
Well, we have a financing contingency for a piece of property that we're trying to purchase, and if we don't meet that deadline by March 5th, then another buyer is going to come in and purchase the property, and we won't be able to expand our operation and continuing to grow our business.
Jonathan, thank you so much for the call. Helena, there are a number of certainly issues here around food, even for producers as they trying to secure money.
Absolutely. And it's not just, there's loans, as Jonathan mentioned, that might help an operation expand their production. There's also operating loans that farmers can get financing from USDA to actually purchase what they need for their production year, for planting, for actually running their operation. So if this continues to drag on, we're going to see a lot of stress on many different levels. It's going to be researchers, scientists who are expecting grants, nonprofits that work on nutrition that were expecting grants, farmers that were expecting loans or maybe about to close on a loan in this case, in Jonathan's case. And Jonathan, you should definitely email me. We should talk about this more. This idea that USDA being closed puts business, kind of grinds business to a halt, is, I think, one of the undercovered parts of the shutdown. And the other thing is, if you're a big or even a small, you know, grain, let's say you grow corn or soybeans and you're eligible for trade aid payments that the Trump administration has pledged, you know, because of all the trade stress and the tariffs, those payments are also now halted. So there's kind of multiple impacts to agricultural producers of all types. And that's just one slice of USDA that we're talking about. So the impacts, I think, can be multiplied on quite a large scale.
Helena, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Helena Bottomiller-Evich is a senior food and agriculture reporter for Politico Pro. Up next, it's news. Then we talk about the femtech boom. Femtech is a startup industry marketing itself as a way for women to take control of their bodies and health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Women's health technology is a growing multi-million-dollar market. Femtech, technology apps or medical devices that service the specific health needs of women, is on the rise. And these startups are beginning to find angel investment, which have traditionally come from men. And these companies are marketing themselves to women who are worried about their fertility. Anna Altman has been writing about femtech. Her pieces have been in The New Yorker and The New York Times, and her latest article in The New Republic is called Mommy and Data. Anna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in 2013, a woman designed a period tracker app because there wasn't anything out there, and she wanted to better track her cycles. So here we are 5 years later. Where is femtech today?
Well, things have really exploded since then. There are dozens of apps now that allow women to track their periods and their fertility. There are apps that target people who are trying to get pregnant, people who are trying to prevent pregnancy. And there are tons of tests and at-home delivery services and apps that just cater themselves to all sorts of needs. So whether it's quickly getting antibiotics for a UTI or having home-delivered organic tampons come to your house every month.
How good are these products, these apps, and these other devices? How good are they for women?
Well, they really run the gamut. I would say that the companies that sort of fall under the heading of femtech, they range from the frivolous to the really significant. You know, I think that a lot of these products are offering things that are not available to women, and that's a really great thing. I think some are marketing themselves in such a way that they're promising things that they maybe are not totally able to deliver. And so, I think it's helpful to break it down more into the different categories. Specifically, I wrote about a company called Cellmatics. They're a company run by a woman named Pri Bime. She is a molecular biologist, and it's really a science-based company. They're doing a lot of scientific research, and I think that they're bringing a lot of value to their product because of the science and the research that they have backing it, whereas some other companies, like, you know, you can buy grooming tools for your pubic hair, and that to me strikes me as more frivolous and perhaps less important.
So, Anna, was this traditionally a market that went unfilled, or are women more in tune with what products work for them, or is it both?
Yeah, I think that it's really has been historically been an underserved market. I mean, if you think about contraception, for example, oral contraception hasn't changed very much in the last 50 or 60 years. There have been slight changes, but there's not a lot of new products on the market that really are bringing new options to women. And so only in the last 10 years, I would say, has Silicon Valley and sort of the venture capital and private equity world really been thinking about making money in this and offering new products that haven't been available to women until now.
And women's infertility used to be a pretty niche issue, but in recent years we've heard about companies offering egg freezing to their female employees, like in Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, Apple. Why have we seen this issue become more mainstream over the past decade?
Well, I think there are a couple different reasons. I mean, one is that women are staying, are getting more education, they're staying in the workforce, they're really trying to build their careers. And as a result, a lot of women and families are waiting until much later in life to start families, to have children. And yeah, I think that companies like Facebook and Apple that offer these kinds of services, they're recognizing that the women that they work for them, they work really hard. They maybe don't feel yet that they've reached a place in their career where they're ready to step back and have children or maybe take the time off that they that might require. The other thing that really changed is that in 2012, the technology of egg freezing went from being something that was presented as experimental to being something that was promoted and acceptable to be used in a more commercial way. And so, that before 2012, egg freezing had been around for a while, but it was really used for women who had cancer or something like that, where they were going to have some kind of medical treatment that might really impact their fertility. And so they would freeze their eggs outside the body so that they would be able to have children after their medical treatment. And then after 2012, the idea that you could opt as a woman who maybe wasn't ready to have children yet, but wanted to preserve the idea of being able to have your children later in life, that became a possibility, and I think that that was a really big change point in this industry.
But the price point of egg freezing, has that stayed pretty constant? I mean, it's really high.
It's very expensive. Egg freezing costs on average about $16,000, and then there's additional costs associated with storage. That usually costs about $500 a year, and then it often costs, you know, around $6,000 to unfreeze the egg and fertilize it and transfer it once you're ready to get pregnant. IVF is another thing that costs a lot of money. It's around $20,000 on average in the U.S. I think that's one of the really big problems in the fertility industry, too, is that these things are very expensive. A lot of insurance plans don't cover it. And so the idea that companies might cover this for their employees has been a big sales point for companies trying to draw talent. That said, for most women, that's not possible. Or for most families, this can really be a huge financial strain. And there's not a lot of progress at the moment in making this more affordable for more people.
Anna Altman is with us. She's a writer and editor based in Washington, D.C. She's been writing about femtech. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you use a fertility tracking or period tracking app? Have you found it helpful, useful, or do you think apps like this are a waste of money? Do you think companies with feminist marketing are exploitative, or do you think it's a positive thing, even if they're selling you something? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So how have these companies, these new tech companies that are focused on women, how have they found their startup money?
So I think that more and more venture capitalists have become wise to the fact that this is a industry that's growing and that there's a lot of money to be made. I read in one report that the femtech industry is projected to be worth $50 billion by 2025, and egg freezing as an industry is worth almost $2 billion a year. So, I think they realize that even though this seems like a niche thing, that it only, you know, I think one of the initial hesitations was that when you think about backing fertility or women's health products, you think, well, I'm only than making a product that's available to half the population. But in fact, infertility affects a lot of people, men and women. I think they realized that they had been sort of closed-minded about something that maybe was taboo, but now they're seeing is really an opportunity to make money.
And certainly angel investors are mostly men, so it's really convincing men that there is money to be had in these types of companies, in these types of startups.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So how are these companies marketing themselves to women? Are they going about it in different ways?
Yeah, they are. I mean, I think that one of the things that I saw that was pretty standard across the board is that a lot of these women's health companies want women to think that that these tools are going to give them more control or give them more knowledge than they otherwise have. As we already mentioned, there's a lot of taboo around talking about infertility or fertility, trying to get pregnant, any of those things. And so The idea that there might be services or tools that you could use that could give you more information, that could give you accurate information, is really appealing to a lot of people. However, what really struck me when I interviewed experts about this is that a lot of these products are marketed in such a way that they exacerbate women's existing anxieties. There are companies that are telling women that if they measure their ovarian reserves or if they test themselves to see if they have certain genetic conditions, that they will feel more in control of their future, that they'll feel empowered. But that control is actually very elusive. There are no tests or procedures to date that can accurately predict when and how a woman will be able to get pregnant. And so the idea that you can regularly take a test and have peace of mind isn't exactly true.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Sheila joining us from Appleton. Good morning, Sheila.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a whole different purpose for this app that I use it for, is my daughter has autism. And so it comes as a complete and total shock every single month to her that we call it Shark Week. But by having this app, we're able to give her a bit of a heads up of, you know, do you have the proper equipment for school? Are you ready? And we're able to work with that every month. And it's helped eliminate so much stress in the household.
Oh, wow. Sheila, we'd never had thought of that would have such an impact in that way. How long have you been using that cycle tracking app?
She is 12 years old. We've been using it for 2 years.
Yeah.
And we have had minimal meltdowns, wardrobe malfunctions, all kinds of other things that just, even not special needs teenagers, but every one of us has a story about that little spot on the chair.
Well, Sheila, thank you so much for your call. Anna, your thoughts on that and taking these apps in new directions?
Yeah, Sheila, thank you so much for sharing that. That's something that I personally haven't thought about, and I think that's a really important point. I think that it's true that a lot of these apps help women, period tracking apps help women sort of be prepared for this time of the month that can be really disruptive, in, whether it's in terms of mood or, you know, having your pads and your tampons available. So I think that's a point that's really well taken, and I appreciate your sharing that story. I'm glad that it's been helpful to your family.
We're talking about the femtech market. We're talking technology, apps, gadgets focused on female health. This industry could be worth $50 billion by 2025. We're looking at the rise of femtech and what we should watch, how these products are evolving and being marketed. Anna Altman is our guide. Her recent piece in the New Republic is called Mommy and Data. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use a fertility tracking app? Have you found it helpful, or do you think apps like this are not useful? Do you think companies with feminist marketing are exploiting women? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Femtech is the intersection of technology and women's health. It's a growing industry. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One business making waves in this marketplace is Ava. It's a Swiss firm that's developed the world's first fertility monitoring bracelet. Other businesses are springing up. LV has developed a device to help women with pelvic floor problems recover. Writer Anna Altman is watching this industry. Her new article in the New Republic is called Mommy and Data. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the femtech market? Are you using a device or an app that is related to this industry? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones now with Tony joining us from Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So I think some of this stuff should be also geared toward men. I realize that sounds kind of silly, but when my wife and I are going to try to have a kid, it would be nice to be included in some of that kind of stuff. So if, you know, on your app you're able to say, oh, well, you know, send my data to this person too, that would be awesome because, you know, not even just for the whole fertility thing, but then, you know, I kind of have a heads up about all the other emotional stuff that comes along with that sort of thing.
Interesting, Tony. Thank you so much for that. Anna, you know, building off of this, this is not just about women.
Yeah, absolutely. To Tony's point, you know, there are some of the fertility tracking apps, there are settings where you can share the information with another person or with other people for that matter. I know that there are couples that are using it in that way, so that whether they want to, whether they're thinking about trying to conceive or just trying to stay on the same page about menstruation, that's definitely an option. There are also a lot of products that are geared towards men. I would say it's less dominant because it's a little bit less complicated to figure some of that stuff out than it is sometimes for women. But there are at-home fertility tests for men, and that stuff is coming online and becoming more available and readily accessible as well.
Tony, thanks for the call. Let's go to Mara now in La Crosse with thoughts. Mara, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question is more geared towards effectiveness. So I'm on TRICARE insurance, and I lose it this May, and unfortunately my IUD is set to be replaced as well. So I've been looking into cycle tracking as an alternative, and my confidence in that is just a little weary. And to make a point of piggybacking off your last caller, I don't know that my partner would be exactly comfortable trusting this elusive new app as something as important as birth control, if that makes any sense.
Oh, wow, Mara, great question. How are these apps filling a healthcare void and being reliable as a form of birth control?
Yeah, that's a really good question. A lot of the cycle tracking apps, they're not certified as a way to be used as contraception. They're a way to sort of create what's called it can be used as sort of a fertility awareness method. And there are ways to kind of supplement apps to make them more effective. I mean, a lot of people turn to using a certain kind of thermometer to check your basal body temperature. That can sort of indicate when you're ovulating. And there are other physical symptoms, too, that you can look for that can contribute. There's one app that has been certified by the FDA as a form of digital contraception, and that app is called Natural Cycles. It includes the app itself is free, but you also have to purchase the thermometer to go along with it. And it indicates to you what days you're fertile and what days you're not, and basically tells you that on the days that when you're getting close to your fertile period, that you either want to abstain from having sex or use another kind of contraceptive method. And so I think that kind of sort of double approach of using an app to help you be aware of your fertile period and then using a backup method as well can be a good option. So that might be something to look into.
And what is that called again?
It's called Natural Cycles.
Natural Cycles. Mara, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Tanya now in Mineral Point. Hi, Tanya.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to mention that my daughter-in-law 2 years ago used an ovulation app, and it worked wonderfully for her. But I will tell you, and then bumping it up to the pregnancy app once she became pregnant, in my world, as a 57-year-old now grandmother, it was amazing to me to see Femtech turn to Famtech as my son was engaged with his wife in discussing every evening the progress of not only ovulation, but the pregnancy as well. I learned things from my son that I didn't know going to the library reading books. So I think that these apps are amazing. I don't think that they take advantage of women. I think they help us. I think they strengthen the bonds of marriage. And they just made the whole process of pregnancy and childbirth that much more exciting for my son, who's a very engaged father. I would encourage anybody to take a look at these apps and maybe test them out and try them.
I think, Tanya, you coined a new term, Famtech. Anna, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think that in a very basic way, these tools are providing more information and more education to people. And if it makes that information more accessible so that, you know, you don't have to ask other people or go to the library, but you can look at your phone and learn about, you know, as you were referencing, sort of the progress of the pregnancy. And, you know, I know some of these apps do things like they'll tell you each week what size the fetus is and compare it to a fruit or a vegetable. And that stuff can be, it can be very engaging and it can be really educational. So I think that's true that there is a place for that for sure.
So, Anna, as you watch and report on this industry, where is it headed and what are you watching for?
So I think that what I'm excited about is to see where some companies like Cellmatics that I wrote about are able to take this in terms of creating new therapeutic products for people. So I know that actually after my article was published, Cellmatics announced that it has a new biosciences division, and one of its first projects is that it's collaborating with the Gates Foundation to find a next-generation oral contraceptive. As I mentioned before, you know, oral contraception hasn't changed that much in a long time, and the side effects can be significant for people. A lot of people don't like the idea of taking synthetic hormones, or they find that their body doesn't tolerate it. And so I'm really excited to see where companies like Cellmatics that are really digging into the science and bringing new drugs into the pipeline that could really impact women in their health across their entire lives, whether it's contraception or helping women with the menopause transition or helping with fertility treatment, all of those things. I'm hoping that those things start coming soon. Unfortunately, it might be a little while yet, but that's my hope.
Well, yeah, so Cellmatics is really seizing perhaps on this opportunity where oral contraception and the pill could perhaps be enhanced through technology.
Yeah, and in Cellmatics' case in particular, I mean, they're really looking at genomics. I mean, genomics has made huge advances in other areas of health, specifically cancer is one that comes to mind. But genomics really hasn't been harnessed to help women better know what their bodies need, and they really see an opportunity there, and they're pursuing that.
Is there competition in this market, or do you see it being flooded at all?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that in certain areas, I would say that there is, you know, that maybe they're getting towards more of a saturation point, I think. But again, the need is there. I mean, people are interested in, people need fertility treatment. They're interested in freezing their eggs. And so the more solutions that are coming online that address those things, I think there's demand for it. I think that one of the things that's interesting about the market is that, to go back to your earlier question about why venture capitalists and angel investors are kind of wising up to this, is that they're realizing that the money isn't just in treating older women who are spending a lot of money trying to conceive. It's in persuading younger women who are still in their 20s to start worrying about their future fertility now.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Anna Altman is a writer and editor based in Washington, D.C. She's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and her most recent piece is in The New Republic. It's called Mommy and Data. Just ahead, we look at the role migrant workers have in the dairy industry. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're with us on the Ideas Network.